Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2020. This is the fifth night, and this is the second stream. And this is with Josh Neal, who some of you will remember from YouTube over the last few years. And he's still active, and he was recently doxxed, but he's still going. So that's good. So welcome, Josh, to Millennial. Thanks for appearing.
Howdy, Woz. Thanks for having me. Merry Christmas. Happy Yule.
Kwanzaa, thank you.
The rest of it.
Thank you. So you wanted to speak first about the book that you're publishing. I have linked below to The Politically Incorrect Guide to Dating, Volumes 1 and 2. So that's in Amazon, Britain and US. So hopefully people will look at that. What do you want to say?
Well, thanks for that. I kind of put those two together. They're the intellectual red-haired stepchild of my life. So, I mean, they're out there. If you want to take a look at them, it'd be appreciated. But the real thing that I'm excited about is this book that I'm publishing with Imperium Press, who you will be having a little bit later on in this month. The book is titled American Extremist, The Psychology of Political Extremism. And I wrote it during lockdown, basically, when there was nothing else to do.
A lockdown project.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's probably was the best way to spend that time. Developed a wicked nicotine habit, but it helped me push through several sleepless nights, powering through to 5 a.m. to get the work done. But it was, I guess, a little bit of a rewind. I started podcasting in 2016 with my friend and co-host, Jefferson Lee. And at that time, I was applying for my PhD, and I really didn't want to do it for a variety of reasons. Chief being among them, that I didn't want to be in school in for another 4 or 5 years into my mid to late 30s. But the climate was everyone knows what the climate has been, but that was a major turning point, and it's only gotten more extreme since then. And there's a little bit of an irony to me that I've contributed a kind of an academic work only once I've been kicked out of the academic world. But what was interesting to me in 2016, one thing I was floating around as a thesis idea was the moral decision making between in different political paradigms, right? Bernie versus Trump, Hillary versus Bernie, so on and so forth. Conservatism versus Trump. And I got into podcasting for a couple of reasons, chiefly among them, I felt like there weren't enough good people doing honest, good work. I'm not the most tremendous egotist in the world. Look, I got a touch of vanity, but, this is not something that I'm very comfortable doing. And I don't really like all of the attention. And it does feed a lot of bad character traits that I have. But it felt like a responsibility. It was a learning process. That was the other part of it, too. It was learning. So, 2016, we were doing basically lowercase L libertarian Trump commentary. And then the alt-right found us. Can I say that?
Say the alt-right. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. The alt-right found us. And, we didn't find the alt-right. That kicked off a whole other kind of intellectual journey. And the doxing experience proved to be kind of the final stop on the railroad, so to speak. Right. I got into this. Go ahead.
When did that happen? Was that at the start of 2019?
November 2019.
Oh, the end of it. Right. Okay. Sorry. You forget these things. Yeah, okay. So do you want to talk about that? Or, for me, being doxed was a very, very complicated experience, and I never actually talked about it in nearly as much depth as I would like to. But other people, it's quite a straightforward thing. Other people don't want to talk about it. It can get a bit boring. It depends on your own circumstances and your own mentality. Would you like to talk about that, or do you not really care?
Yeah, I can touch on it. I'd be curious to hear what was complicated about it for you. Commiserate a little bit there, because I remember reading about it when it happened. But I'll make mine short.
No, please. So you're the guest. You talk about it.
It wasn't so bad. It was terrible, but it wasn't so bad. And I compare it to people who were at that event in 2017, and the fallout of said event in 2017. And, you know, some of those people chose very final solutions to those problems. You know, I lost everything. My career, my home, friends, lovers, hobbies, an income. But, you know, it wasn't so bad, all things considered. And a year later, I'm better off than I was. If I compare December 2020 to December 2019, by most, I'm not totally recovered, but by most metrics, I'm considerably better off. And I needed certain delusions kind of kicked out of my head. I needed to come back down to earth. And the doxing really was a cruel but totally necessary lesson from reality that I think has made me a smarter person. So, yeah, not pleasant. I certainly hope nobody goes through it. But I do think there's a certain kind of paranoia about it in these circles that far outstrips the consequences.
I mean, I remember before it happened to me, I used to be quite paranoid about it. I definitely, on more than one occasion, had a nightmare in which I was doxxed. Like, I would see my name on a website. I dreamt that at least once. So it was on my mind. But yeah, the reality, yeah, there is a lot of paranoia. I think, I was talking to someone else from America about this, and he said that it affects professionals far worse than it affects blue-collar workers because they can get another job fairly easily. The employers don't tend to Google your history. They don't tend to care that much. But if you're a professional, as you were and are, then it has more serious consequences. Would you say anything about that?
Yeah, well, I'll never go back into a classroom and I'll never have another client as a psychologist for as long as I live. But those were things I was very disenchanted with and had a very difficult time accepting for the entire duration that was my career. You know, I never felt like I'm a teacher. I'm the guy who should be educating people. I know enough to be doing this job. I have the credentials to be doing this job. I have always viewed education as a morally bankrupt institution. So there's a certain kind of like, yeah, am I contributing to one of the great evils of American society? And, you know, as far as therapy is concerned, you know, that's also a funny business. Not funny, haha. Queerly funny. I think I did good work, everything I did. Most people were very happy for my services, but you know, if you need help, talk to a priest or your mom and dad, husband, wife. The reason that therapy exists is because all those social relations are so impoverished, and there's other reasons too. But you know, I hear people talk about how that industry is a sham, and that's not totally wrong. But you know, you're playing sham car mechanics. They're pretty. Plenty of sham pizzeria joints. 90% of everything is terrible, and for different reasons for different people. But I'm glad to be out, honestly. And you know, I'm kind of a person who gets, if I'm in a situation of comfort, I'll stay. And the arc of my life has always been some cataclysmic event jolts me out of my stupor and into a more productive phase of my life. So yeah, I mean. Thanks, New York Post. I appreciate it.
One of the things that I would always wanted to do was direct films or TV shows. And now and then it does hit me. You know, I started my channel because I was in a dreadful state. My life was a wreck and I had nothing to lose as I saw it. But in retrospect, I did have something to lose, which was the possibility that one day I would direct films, you know, the potential for that, that possibility. And that is what I lost. And, you know, I now know that I will never direct a film. I will never direct a TV drama or whatever. But the consolation is, and this is what I tell myself, well, if I were working in the media, I'd fucking hate it. I'd absolutely hate it because much in the same way as you feel about education, the modern media is the purveyor of poison. And I would have to go along with that. I would have to pretend to enjoy it and approve of it and agree with it and devise new ways to deliver this poison to the public. That would effectively be my job, and to ensure that it was purveyed to them. So in a way, and obviously I miss this career that I never had. But at the same time, I think, well, it maybe be careful what you wish for. You know, if you got it, you might absolutely hate it. And in all likelihood, you would hate it, ironically. It's a shame. It's not a nice thing to say. It's a reflection on the society that we live in, because education, of course, should be a good thing. It should be a nourishing, honourable, enriching institution. But what would you say about the state of education today in America, in the West?
That's a big one. Well, I mean, there's a lot of problems. I said this to you the first millennial I did. We should stop educating people. and that might have been motivated by my, you know, personal kind of frustration with the industry, so to speak. Too many people are being taught or propagandized that university education is a necessary good, that it's necessary to, in fact, vital to a middle class existence, that the kind that teachers should be a venerated class. I knew one guy in a band I played with. He knew as a teacher, he's like, "Man, dude, you know, teachers are greatest." I'm like, "Oh, I appreciate that you think that way, but most of the teachers I know are not that great." There are people who didn't want to be there, who didn't need to be there, both as educators and students. The quality of education was very poor. I mean, it was just kind of a loveless experience. I don't mean to get weird, but there should be a certain kind of love between a teacher and a student, a mentor and the mentee. There has to be some kind of, maybe love is not the right word, but there's an intimacy there. Like, I should care, and you're investing in these people, and you envision, you see in them a person that could be that they don't see yet, and your function is to help put them on the path so that they become that person. And I think a lot of educators I met weren't like that. And the reason they weren't like that is because they were disenchanted by the reality of how American higher education works, which is they're teaching people that don't want to be taught, who shouldn't be there. It's a big mess.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a similar thing, probably the very same process happened in Britain when my parents went to university in the early 70s, apparently it was 1 in 20 people who went to university at that time. And now I think it's 1 in 3 or 1 in 2 who go now. And that obviously is going to change the institution and massively distort what it does. You know, not just how it performs, but what it actually achieves as an end result. And I think this is just one example of how we have just discarded standards. You know, the very idea of what is it to be an educated man has completely transformed. It's not, and the thing is, you'd think it would go from, okay, the dreaming spires of Cambridge to technical training, and now you're a damn good engineer, now you're a damn good programmer. But most people coming out of university aren't even that. So it hasn't gone in that direction either. I don't really know what university achieves now.
Well, it fattens the pockets of the administration, that's for sure. It's a sham. And I was very forthright about that with my students, and I think that's why they appreciated the ones that did anyway. But to kind of steer back on course, so the doxing revealed a serious hole in my worldview. That whole time, 2016 and 2019, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to worry about these lefties, journalists, anti-fascist Twitter hunters. And the doxing came from inside the house, you know, and that was something that was very revealing and contributed greatly to the book I wrote.
Yes, that's a very... maybe you could speak specifically about what you mean by inside the house. But in my experience, that is, I think, usually the way it happens. It's not some dedicated Marxist or, you know, gender fluid maniac who's done lots of months of hunting and research. It's some prick in your own life who knows you from a previous job or from school, or even in your town, who's seen you at the supermarket, and there, or it's a family friend, in inverted commas. It's someone who decides to just fuck you up. That's usually, in my experience, how doxing actually occurs.
Well, that would have been that. I wish that was the case. Sort of, it would have reflected better on me as a person. You know, like I said, I got into this not intending to go in a white identity alt-right position. So you could say certain OPSEC strategies were not there for certain points of time. I was operating under my legal name and publishing and blah, 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 blah. And I got involved, and I'm just, you know, not to stir up old rivalries or get people riled up about certain things. I was involved with some people, and I shared just a wee bit too much information. And one of the reasons I don't have Twitter, I'm not, other than managing the EBL account, I'm not on social media, is, you know, there's a particular, I'm full of piss and vinegar, let's put it that way. And I riled up some of these former allies, and that precipitated the dox. And so, you know, from inside the house was ostensibly the online community that I was trading in. And so, I mean, that just reflects poor, you know, my own naivete. I don't, people are going to do what people are going to do. And if they're not the most virtuous people, well, that's par for the course. So, I mean, that's a failing that I have to take on myself. And I would encourage people watching to not repeat that.
Yeah, it's very disappointing when people inside the movement are the source of betrayal and discord and sabotage in the movement. Is just disgusting, and it's something that I constantly try to discourage, but you know, people just do it. You know, I've had similar things myself in this year. It's amazing, you know, people who you've known for ages and who you think you can trust, and then they screw you over. It's quite incredible. I don't know why that is. I think it's something to do with the movement itself, that we actually are dissidents. So there's this enormous pressure, or maybe it's just wherever there's power to be had, wherever there's social power to be seized, people of a certain mindset will go around seeking it and then using it, often sadistically, for its own sake.
Well, I'm sure they felt slighted by me, and I know they felt justified in doing what they did. I disagree, obviously, but from their point of view, they felt it was the right thing to do. But yeah, I think it has more to do with the way in which certain kinds of social technologies are flattened, democratized, made available to everybody in an equal and all-encompassing way, and that's not how life outside of the internet works. That's not how, you know, tightly hierarchically organized societies work, you know. So yeah, there's something imminent to the internet that allows for kind of mundane psychopathic behavior to proliferate, which was also very instructive for me and formed one of the chapters in the book that will be published in January. So yeah, Imperium Press, American Extremist, The Psychology of Political Extremism. If I die tomorrow, I will be happy because I finally contributed. I feel like I finally done something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's a thing that I think it's in Islamic culture, actually, that a book is to produce a book is one of the finest and most honorable things that a man can do. Not that I'm advocating Islam, just in case anyone gets excited about that. I'm not. Just it just came to my mind when Josh said that just now. So would you like to talk about the book, and then we'll move on to the main topic, which is 2020. Just introduce people to what they'll get from this book, why they might want to read it.
Well, let me ask you this, Rose. Were you ever a fan of The Killers, the band?
Not really. I didn't mind them, but they were not my kind of genre.
Sure. Well, their first album was obviously very big. And when they were gearing up for the second one, the singer, Brandon Flowers, on the press tour was saying, this is the biggest rock and roll album since Radiohead's OK Computer. And he kept talking it up and he kept talking it up. And then the album came out, it flopped. And now who knows who the Killers are anymore. They haven't had a hit, like a top 10 single in like a decade. I say that because I'm about to commit the same kind of sin. I think that this book will do for Imperium Press what Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism did for Zero Books. And I think that's not an unjustified comparison. You know, Capitalist Realism came out roughly at the time of the housing market collapse in 2009. And it was a very sharp critique of capitalism, and it was a very incisive look into the education system, mental health, and psychiatry in America. And it made Mark Fisher and Zero Books basically household names. Not quite, but, you know, as far as political literary world is concerned, household names. I think this book could do that for Imperium Press for the same reasons. I wrote it in 22, started as COVID was the story and finished as the election was the story. And 2020 kind of gave us this whole continuum of political failure. And so I feel like the book really encompasses that. And so it's not just, oh, here are a couple of ideas I have. It's pretty nifty. It's got a cute cover. It's like taking a moment in time, encapsulating it. And it's available forever. You know, you're not just reading some knucklehead's thoughts. You're reading almost, to some degree, a kind of an autobiographical, you know, societal-wide autobiography of a particular moment. So I think the other reason the book is important is psychology as a discipline, especially since the turn of the century, has been a very destructive discipline, and psychology has been at the forefront of many of psychologists are basically they're the right hand man of the state at this point. They're on the leading front of a lot of the cultural changes that we've seen over the last several decades, and psychologists, sociologists, literary criticists, is that a word? You know,
literary critics.
There it is. Thank you. I wrote a book. criticists. I'm going to use criticist anyway, just in case that kind of later down the road.
An alternative would be literati. I quite like that. But
oh, yes. That's a good one. Yeah. It's kind of a tired meme, but the Frankfurt School, Marcuse, Horkheimer, Adorno, a lot of these people were psychologists or psychoanalytically literate. The CIA and the OSS published reports from Ewan Cameron and Henry Murray, and they, that was basically, I guess I can't use this word, anti-no-no guys from the mid-20th century. You know, it was basically psychological profiles of leading illiberal figures in the mid-20th century.
Right.
And all of that stuff precipitated the vast literature and cultural advance of anti-fascism, extreme neoliberal progressivism. So all the psychological analyses of political types predominantly has come from that milieu, to such a degree that there's a very small corner of the psychological world which has pushed back and said, well, actually, is there even this thing called left-wing authoritarianism? That literature does exist, but many people mock that because the idea is there's only right-wing authoritarians. So, I mean, we're all still living with, oh, you right wingers, your guns are your penises. You have small penises. Daddy molested you. Destroy the family to destroy effism. Trying to get around these words.
It's to the point where even right wing people, when faced with left wing authoritarianism, call them fascists. And say, oh, it's right wing. It's right wing authoritarianism. It must be because that's the only kind of authoritarianism I know. It's really amazing.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I think you were talking to Dr. Johnson before about that kind of generational difference in viewing these kinds of issues, which is profound. We're living under Tyrannus Boomeris, you know, that's my kind of Latin.
I've never heard that one before. That's really good. I like that.
So, I mean, my book, I think it's not the final statement on this issue, but it is, I think, the first corrective measure to getting us to think about politics, the political archetypes, in a clear-headed way. And one of the central points I make in the book is that, look, it's the normal people versus the psychopaths. And that's, if you want to boil it down to the absolute lizard brain level where everyone gets it and it's perennially true, it's the normal people versus the psychopaths. Somebody asked on a recent stream of mine with Tyler and Jefferson, you know, what political ideology do you guys ascribe to? What do you call yourselves? And I just said, you know, look, I'm a normal person. I'm a normal guy. I think it's simpler than that. I think it's as simple as that.
I didn't realize you were about to stop speaking, so I was just checking something while you were finishing. I think that, what do you think of the idea that psychopaths are a perennial presence in society, and basically in order to get anything done, you probably are going to be relying on the presence of psychopaths because they are the people who seek power, the people who like to use power, they like glory, personal plaudits, and so on. Do you think that is true, or do you think that's a sort of cope?
I think psychopathy proliferates well beyond its natural limit in contemporary American techno-capital. And there's a study that I quote in my book. One in 10 CEOs fits the characteristic of a psychopath. We have a system that is geared for their success. And what one gentleman whose theoretical model I use in the book, a Polish psychiatrist, Andreas Lobachevsky, talks about how psychopaths basically get to the top of the food chain. And they do it through insinuation and manipulation and undermining. And then once they're there, they clear a space for either other psychopaths or their minions to commandeer whatever that institution is. So we've got a system ripe for taking by very evil people. Look, psychopathy is a wide-ranging continuum. You have like the totally benevolent psychopaths. These are people who are, you know, they're effectively lower. So they're not responding to things in the same way a normal person might, but they're not trying to screw you over. And then the other end you have, you know, like your, I don't know, Nancy Pelosi types or whoever, pick whatever person you think is the embodiment of evil. I'm not saying Pelosi is, but that name came to mind immediately. That's the other end. I don't think you need these people. You don't need these people. In some sense, like you want like a clinician or a surgeon to have a certain cool-handedness, which might be correlated in one way or another to psychopathy, but they're not. Society doesn't thrive on the backs of the spiritually ill.
It's a fascinating topic, and it's something that I am very, very interested in, especially because recently I don't know how much to say about this, but I'm pretty sure I became, over the last sort of 2 years, I became victim to a psychopath. People shouldn't try to guess who it is because he's not a public figure. No one will know him. But it's something that I'm absolutely convinced that this guy is a bona fide psychopath. And I've never been that convinced about this before with anyone else. And it's something that we could really go into and talk about, because I'd love to hear what you would think about this guy if I told you his tricks, the way he works. It's I mean, it's grim and depressing, but it's also, you just can't help but be fascinated by it, because it works. You know, to me, at this point, it's very obvious this guy is a complete piece of shit. And yet I can see him just continuing to charm people and to trick people. It's amazing. Even when news of his exploits spreads around, he's still somehow able to escape condemnation and ostracization, which is what absolutely should happen to him. He's a very dangerous and destructive guy. But one technique, because you were talking about how they clear a path and with trickery and manipulation, and then they clear the way for other psychopaths to join them. One thing that I noticed with him is that one of his main techniques is, well, two. I'll talk about two of them, and then we can move on from this, because these are the two that, well, spring to mind immediately. One of them is that he habitually takes credit for other people's work, so that anything that other people do, it's not attributed to them, so they don't benefit from it reputationally, but he does. So he sort of robs them twice in a way. But the other thing that he does, and I should say that he does nothing of his own, nothing. He produces nothing, he arranges nothing, he organizes nothing. He's just a complete parasite, like absolutely shameless, 100% parasite, who then has contempt for the people he's parasiting off. It's amazing. The other thing he does is he specializes in keeping people apart so that they both people have to rely on him as the intermediary, which maximizes his social power. I mean, it's incredible to watch. It's really amazing.
Yeah, well, that contempt is obviously rooted in, I guess there's maybe two levels to it. This is the creator, I'm not the creator. So there's a naked resentment and envy of the natural power that the creator has that the parasitical psychopath doesn't. And then, in order to deal with that, there has to be that fantasy in the Kleinian sense where I'm somehow superior to this lower person. Well, I can manipulate, you may be able to create that thing, but I got you in my pocket. And so who really has the power? Oh, you made this great little song. Well, not anymore. Everyone thinks I got it, right? So, yeah, I mean, they're very pernicious people. Like you said, we could go on all day.
Oh, yeah. It's a very interesting topic. Because the thing about psychopaths is people tend to think that every psychopath is Hannibal Lecter. And, you know, the very cultured, very well-read, very, very charismatic, very intelligent, very witty. Not at all. Not at all. A lot of them are very, very dull people. They're just extremely cold and calculating.
Yeah, that's another gift Hollywood has given us.
Exactly. All right, so let's go on to the main topic, which is 2020 and your impressions of the year. So I guess this, in a way, would be a sort of live version of your book, in some senses, perhaps. So what would you say are the most, I mean, you watched the previous stream with Greg Johnson. We talked about three main things there. I'm perfectly happy if you want to talk about those same topics, because I'm certain that it would be a very different treatment of them. But what would you say are the main salient things of 2020?
So I made a tweet about this last night on the EPL account. And you know, one thing I keep hearing people say, and this is a source of major contention between people who are nominally right-wing and on the internet, I suppose you could say, I hear people say this all the time, average people have never been more receptive to our ideas than they are right now. And whether we're talking about the fallout of the election, whether we're talking about the fallout of COVID, there's a sense that people are standing on the precipice of a total, fundamental, top-down, psycho-spiritual change. And I don't know if I agree, really. Now, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm just some mook in a basement. What do I know? Virtually everybody else in this community is smarter than I am and has training in this thing, so what do I know? But I don't see that. And, you know, what I see is a tremendous amount of suffering, a tremendous amount of despair, horrors that just are beyond imagine. I was reading 1/3 of Americans are about to be, are basically living under threat of eviction, homelessness. It's, you know, 2009 was bleak. This is many, many times worse.
Yes, yes. This is clearly something much of a different order of magnitude from 2009. As it unfolds, it's going to be much more dramatic than that.
Yeah, and similarly with the BLM riots, there was a lot of chaos in New York, 2012 to 2015. Couldn't get in the Brooklyn Bridge, couldn't get in the Manhattan Bridge. People were getting run over. The cops went on strike for about a week. Maybe it was even 2 weeks. And even that seems to have been eclipsed by this past year, because it's just, because it wasn't just America. You had these kinds of sympathetic riots around the world. I know in the UK, yes, there was quite a bit of that.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, there's a BLM organization in Britain. I can't remember what it is. I think it is just BLM UK or something. And it's, and they on at least one occasion, they did a sort of military march through in London. I mean, it's really incredible that the establishment just stood by and watched that happen. And it looks like a paramilitary organization. It looks like something you'd see in Africa with that. Okay, these guys are going to go and massacre that village next door now. That kind of thing. That's what it looked like. I mean, it quite incredible. So, it could also happen. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I think it also happened in Germany, France, yeah, Sweden as well. I'm not sure now, but yes, it was BLM was a big thing.
So the one-to-one comparison isn't correct, because all these things are happening simultaneously. You're having total economic collapse. You're having racial conflict on the level that the country hasn't seen in half a decade. A sweeping epidemic. Whatever the individual people in the audience may think about the origins or the purposes of these various events, they're all happening, and they're all happening simultaneously. And that, I think, is unique. And the pressure, the volume of that, I think, has the ability to push forth a counter response in a direction that maybe normal people would like to see. But what I see is people being pushed further into their existing priors. And that veneer of illiberal kind of give us our authoritarian moment is just kind of a realpolitik technique to get us back into full speed techno-capital neoliberalism. So I think I saw you talking to Semyagog about this too, and I like the guy. He's very smart. He was on my show, blew my mind with his knowledge. Brilliant guy, very entertaining. Fundamentally disagree. I don't know that we're going into this. It's not 1776 will rise again. You know, we're not going to have that he who shall not be named moment. Can you even say his name on YouTube anymore? InfoWars guy.
Oh, I don't know. Let's just say the InfoWars guy or the Gay Frogs guy. everyone knows who we mean. There is only one.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, he did fire one of his top reporters, so it literally is just one now.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, David Knight. And anyway, let's not get into petty drama.
Okay.
I think part of it stems from, you know, what kind of world I want versus what kind of world these people want. And I see those people as still fundamentally liberal. Now, I'm not naming Semyagog or InfoWars guy in particular, but like the mouth behind that idea. I see these are people who kind of want to return to the cozy comforts of 1983. With your, you know, the top down Van Halen on the stereo, your girls in a nice bikini, maybe you both got a little bag of some white in your pocket, and you're going to watch Wall Street. I don't know, but there's a kind of naive, childlike juvenility to it, where, you know, we're going to be rescued, we're going to be raptured into the perfect America, and I just think we're on this. You know, I've read a lot of Spengler this year. I just don't see how we're not on this continual descent into the inevitable grave of the American Empire. With that being said, I still think the American Empire has legs. That's the other thing that people are talking about this year that makes me scratch my head. And again, I don't have a poli-sci degree. I'm not from the university in this regard. I'm far less well-read than most of the people who are saying the opposite of what I'm about to put forth. I still think the American empire has legs. You know, people are talking about the crisis of neoliberalism, the capitalist crisis. The American empire is so weak. And yeah, look, look, we're at the most embarrassing empire that's ever walked this earth. And we've never looked more pathetic than we do now. But I don't see how that translates to, well, that's it. America's done. I feel like this show could keep on going.
But a minute ago, you were saying that it's over, that we're seeing the decline of the American empire or the American civilization. So can you reconcile this?
I mean, that could take 100 years. It could take 300 years. It could take 700 years. I can't put a timeline on it. It's very obvious we're in the precipitous decline. And you know, I've had a lot of time to read this year. And you hear people saying this 1830, 1790. People have been talking about the decline. If you read Evola, we're just in this perpetual state of decline. You know, we're in a state of involution and not evolution. So the smart people of today are infinitely less competent, less amazing than the smart people of 1,000 years ago. So, I mean, there's a general consensus that we are a fallen people and that we are in a state of descent and not ascent. And I think the fact that, you know, you have movements like transhumanism where there's this mass, not mass per se, but there's this spirit of transcending the human form entirely is nothing but a symptom of the fact that we're just exhausted. We're done. We don't want this anymore. So to reconcile those two things, we're in decline, clearly. The American empire is, I agree, it's a paper tiger. But it's still kind of the only game in town. Barring something that is beyond my imagination, I think it can keep manipulating and coercing and doing whatever it does for quite a little bit while longer.
So it would not be an ideal, it would not be a vision for society, so to speak, or a civilization as such, but it would be a way of living that would perpetuate itself for another few centuries.
Potentially. I mean, again, I could be totally wrong. It could be decades, could be weeks. Who knows? I mean, I really feel like with 2020, everything's on the table. And I didn't really feel that way before.
Yes. I think that the 2020 has brought into focus how many factors are actually at play and how much they're at play. And one thing is that, and this is relevant to what we're saying, the specter of secession has reared its head. Yeah, I see people talking about states seceding from the United States, who didn't talk about this 6 months ago or a year ago, but it now seems to be becoming an inviting prospect for quite a lot of people. What would you say about that? Do you think that's feasible? Do you think that's plausible? Or do you think that's another sort of pie in the sky idea?
I'll have to make this quick because apparently my battery is dying. So I got to run upstairs and get a battery real quick. But people have been talking about secession in America for a very long time. My entire lifetime, the right-wing commentariat has been talking about secession. It is always a hot topic. The spirit of the antebellum South lives on and will continue to live on as a kind of image of romanticized conservative loss, but also as a ideal of this separationist kind of alternative. By virtue of people fleeing the cities, New York has the highest exit rate of any state in the country, and we've lost something like 1.3 or 1.4 million people in the last 10 years. People are separating in a certain sense. And I wonder if we won't hit a critical mass where there's a particular kind of people segregating or separating to a particular part of the country, and that might develop political consequences in the future. I don't think it'll be something like that InfoWars guy moment where we're all with our megaphones and our rifles and our trucks and we're staring down, you know, NATO tanks and the American army. It might be something far less sexy and final, you know, having a sense of finality than that. But it's all talk. Look, man, hopefully the audience doesn't take this the wrong way. I don't know what kind of people are watching. there's so much conservative fantasy going on that it really makes me take nothing these people say seriously. So the secessionist movement, I'm not betting on that. But let me get a battery real quick.
Okay. All right. Okay, I'll mute him while he's away. So, all right. I suppose I just have to hold the fort. I don't know. You tell me, what should I ask him next? Because I'm not sure where to take this conversation. If you can, because it does seem to be he has a lot of ideas, but see, I think he's in the process of working it all out for himself. So it would be wrong to pressure him too much to come up with anything, you know, clear and concise. But of course, that's why it's interesting. He seems to be a guy who's quite happy with, you know, discussing this, and just, you know, not the kind of guy who pretends to have loads of fucking clear, concise answers. And I like that. Okay, someone's just asking me, what flavor do you vape? And it's blackcurrant. All right. So that's the entropy link, and I'll put it in the YouTube as well. And there you go. So if you can think of questions for Josh, that would be quite helpful. Someone says, Josh keeps it real. Yes, I agree.
Test two. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hello. Welcome back. Welcome back.
Thank you for holding down the fort.
That's fine. So I've just given people the entropy link, so there might be some questions coming in. Hopefully there will be. So it seems that 2020 for you has been a year in which the cards were thrown into the air, so to speak, or it became clear just how turbulent and unknowable the future is. What would you say about, if you were to say to someone, compare America, we'll keep it on America, compare America now with America in December 2019, what would you say is different? I mean, how does it feel different?
You know, that's a very difficult question to answer. I'll say this. December 2019, I think, I consider this a personal failing. I was too ensconced in this milieu to really be able to take the world outside of it as it is. And I consider that a failing of my entire broadcasting career. Is I kind of think of the alt-right in like a monomythical way, like Joseph Campbell. Like, we're going into this underground, you know, as normal people. We have this, you're Frodo Baggins, and you got the ring, right? We don't have the ring per se, but, you know, just go with the bad analogy. And we're going into the underground, and the alt-right is the underground, and that's where all the mystical, magical powers you're going to get to come back to the surface and change the world with, right? And a lot of people stay in the underground, and I was stuck in the underground. And I think the point is to come out and have this awakening, this kind of reformation of who you are, to go back out into the real world and do good in the real world and speak to people. So I think that was a real failing for me the last couple of years. So what was different about December 2019 to 2020? 2019, I felt like...
I mean, you'd just been doxxed at that point, let's be fair to you. Yeah. So you would have you'd have had a lot of stuff to deal with at that point.
That's true. I think looking back on it, it's a good question to ask now that I'm thinking about this. Looking back on it, I really do feel like we were in a lull. And what was going on, there's a lot of internecine conflict online, like so much so. And I think maybe it was precipitating what was coming. I'm not sure. I kind of feel like looking back now that there might have been an anticipatory anxiety happening among people in December 2019 that we kind of felt like something was coming. We didn't know what that might have been. We're now in a clear state of despair, but the despair of 2019 was different. I kind of feel like people were not in a good place then, Americans, alt-right, whatever. But it's of a completely different character now than it was there. And it's realer, and it's in your face, and it's like all the problems are explicated. It's in high definition. It's very clear what's going on. And it wasn't so clear then. So I think maybe the difference is the clarity. But here's what bothers me, is with all the clarity that we have, it seems like people are retreating into fantasy in the face of this I'm going to contradict myself slightly here. In the face of unvarnished reality, people are retreating. Now, here's the contradiction. It isn't really unvarnished, because this has also been like the most heavily propagandized year too. Like, I feel like there are certain very real conflicts, pressures that we've been confronted with. And then this madcap media attempt to
gaslight. Yeah.
To contextualize it in service of neoliberal hegemony. So there's as much opportunity to, you know, to use a Fisherian term, to step out of the desert of the real, and then, but to also go back into it, you know, it's the fork is in the road, and I just kind of wish more people would go in the right direction. I'm assuming, of course, I'm going the right direction. I think I am, but I guess the next couple of months will tell.
Excellent. Is there anything more that you'd like to say, or would you like to leave it at that?
I guess I'll just take a crack at what 2021 will look like.
Yes, go ahead.
I don't think we'll see the Kraken. There will be no Kraken. So Biden will take office. I think things will see this on Twitter already. Like, I saw a screen cap of a bunch of like well-to-do white liberals, and they're all like, oh, thank God Biden is office. I don't have to think about it. And you really see the degree to which Trump was such an antagonistic force psychologically on these people. Like, really, like, weighted on them.
It's like a thorn in their side, which has suddenly been taken out, and now they can breathe a sigh of relief.
Yeah, I had clients in 2016, Trump anxiety, like, literally. Anxiety. And that was, you know, they published articles in the New Yorker about it. It was a real thing. Well-to-do white liberals having their nice, pretty picture of America soiled by this vulgar guy from Queens, New York. So there's going to be latent, becoming manifest conflict. We've seen, I mean, there was a shooting in New York not too long ago. There's a rally, a BLM riot a few weeks back. I don't think there's going to be a pumping of the brakes on the ground level social conflict. But it's going to remain ground level. Like, this is the thing with the Civil War issue. They're thinking like, oh, because based MAGA guy with a Trump flag is duking it out with, you know, the American black bloc or whatever. That's not the same thing as the Civil War, dude. Like, those are both normal people with no power. They don't have the ear of the power structure. You know, this is just going to be a bum fight. This is Kimbo Slice, circa 2007, a bunch of dudes in their backyard hitting each other with cement blocks or whatever. It's not going to be, you know, a Matt Damon movie. So I think things are we're gonna be trying to corral the beast in 2021. I think it's gonna prove to be difficult. But I don't know. I got faith in my neoliberals. I think they can do it.
Here's a question for you. You said that in 2016 you had clients with Trump derangement syndrome, and now, and their pretty idea of the world had suddenly been disrupted. Now they're going to get what they want. They're going to get what they wish for. They're going to get Biden back, the Democrats back in power. Do you think that something else in the future, do you think that will disrupt their pretty view of, like, basically when whites are no longer a majority in America, that kind of thing? How long do you think it will be before liberals, once again, their pretty view of reality is disrupted?
You know, this is, you got to give the white PMC liberals their due, the professional managerial types. They are the real white nationalists. They marry other whites. They move to white-only neighborhoods. They go to the schools that are most white. They live in segregated communities. They have white hobbies. You know, this is a group of people that book Stuff White People Like was made for, like 10, 15 years ago. These are the real white nationalists, in the sense of, like, they live in a white bubble, and they really only want their whiteness. And everything that they do about woke is kind of primitive and religious, like, like they're buying indulgences.
It's a fashion accessory.
I think it can be punctured at any time, really. So I don't have a concrete answer at you. I don't know what 2021 is going to look like in that regard. If the craziest of crazy things happens, and Trump somehow does, I don't know, there's massive things that I cannot speak about, proven to have happened, and he does take office, you're going to see heads explode. But I also don't think that's going to happen. So we'll have to wait and see.
All right. Okay, I'll ask you two questions that have come in. Do you see a new identity for Western people beyond the American empire continuing or not? A new identity for Western people.
I know there are people who are trying. You have, like, no white kilt with his Promethean, or who's this other guy, Jason Giorgiani, with his Prometheanism. You have Mark Brahman's Apollonianism. Tough question. Look, there's always some crazy guy with his world, you know, his grand transformational idea right around the corner. And that's not an insult to Mark, Jason, or Giorgiani. What I would like to see is a radical post-American white identity that is healthful, eugenic, positive, doesn't have the baggage of the people who've come before us. Like, this is one thing I was thinking about mentioning to you before, like, you know, we're the only people, I think, who can set things right, partly because it's our problem. You know, the West is our Frankensteinian monster. And when you knuckle down to the handful of people, maybe in this milieu and adjacent milieus, who are the right ones to do this, look, man, I mean, we're the only people who really care about things. We're the only people who care about the environment. We're the only people who care about, renewable or sustainable energy. And I'm deliberately using those neoliberal buzzwords because they're not necessarily evil. It's just that evil people are speaking them. Whether that means nuclear energy or whatever the case might be, we're the only people who really care about what's important, and we're the only people who can really care about doing good in the world. So, whether something arises organically out of that, maybe that'll be this new identity.
Okay. And one last question. This should be an easy one, but it might not be. Is New York City still worth living in?
Absolutely not. absolutely not. It's just a festering, pus-filled wound on the face of America. So where I work, used to be a very busy part of New York. Lots of people. Let's just leave it at that. It is now totally barren. If there were between 6,000 and 10,000 people a day moving through this area, now there's about 200 to 300. And maybe a tenth of those people are the homeless, the drug-addled, and the deranged that you will confront in the metro, on the street, wherever. New York City, it's just the worst. It's the fucking worst.
It was bad when I was there. I visited New York once, and it was 4 years ago, around the time of the last election. And the subway, I was quite surprised by how dilapidated it was. I mean, you know, this is probably the most famous city in the world. And the subway looked bloody awful. I mean, it was just decrepit. And I did wonder, will a Trump presidency breathe new life into these places? No, not at all. Amazing.
It breathes life into the Dow. It breathes life into Wall Street. Mm. I mean, those numbers went through the roof. But, God, yeah, 20, I mean, it's always been bad, dude. Like, it's just, New York just fucking sucks. It just sucks.
I'm sorry to hear that. Maybe it'll be like, you know, in the 80s again, with all these films that were very cool. But the reality of it is it's not nice to live in. All right. Okay, well, let's leave it at that. This has been a very interesting interview, and I've enjoyed it. So thank you for coming on.
pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. I'll be back in 40 minutes with E. Michael Jones. That will be on DLive only for obvious reasons. So I will see you then. But okay, well, Josh is gone. So, okay, I hope you enjoyed this. Thanks for watching. I'll see you in a wee while.